This podcast was produced by ORFM Dunedin with support from New Zealand On the Air.
Otago Access Radio, in partnership with Otago Polytech, brings you Blowing Bubbles. Blowing Bubbles brings you positive conversations with people in their bubbles around the world. How are people living their bubble lives? Working from home, keeping kids entertained, and staying connected and getting exercise. And how are these things presenting us with the opportunities to find new ways of living? Every weekday, the Sustainable Lens team of Samuel Mann, Shane Gallagher and Mara Karatai reach out from their bubbles to chat with interesting and positive people around the world. Broadcast on Otago Access Radio 105.4 FM and streamed and podcast on oar.org.nz and sustainablelens.org, bringing connection, joy, kindness and peace in the days ahead.
Welcome to Blowing Bubbles by Sustainable Lens, positive conversations with people in their bubbles, their safe spaces around the world. I'm Samuel Mann, and today I am at the University of Huddersfield. I am with James Scott van Deventer, who is a lecturer in the Department of Management at the University of Huddersfield. Welcome, James. Thank you for joining me.
Thank you for having me.
Now, I can tell some accents, and I can tell that's not a Huddersfield accent. Did you grow up?
You're indeed correct. I grew up in Los Angeles originally, so I'm a little ways from where I grew up originally, but it's a sort of bit of a journey eastward. I went to my undergrad in Washington, D.C., master's in Edinburgh, PhD in Manchester, and now just a bit further east in Hunter.
What did you want to be when you grew up?
When people used to ask me that question, I would never give them a straight answer, so I'm not going to give you one either. It was always a process of discovery, and I think it still is what I want to be, even though I'm a bit more grown up. I think that's a kind of openness and a willingness to learn and explore new directions that I've held on to.
What was it like growing up in LA?
It was the only world I knew, and only having stepped away can I maybe assess a little bit the car-centric urban sprawl, model of urban development that's sort of characterized increasingly other urban contexts as well. But it was, apart from spending a lot of time in a car, it was hot and sunny, two things that have changed a little bit now that I've settled in England. but it was overall it was thoroughly enjoyable, childhood.
And a journey, process of discovery that led you to management. Why management? How did you get there?
Yeah. My father was a CEO of a nonprofit. He retired recently, so that provided me, I guess, an early, interesting context to be thinking about what it is to make an impact in the world. The nonprofit context, in particular, is different from other management contexts, I think I've always been interested in the role business and organizations play in society. So during my undergraduate in the U.S., you have a sort of major and a minor focus in your studies. So I majored in economics, but I minored in business, which sort of gave me some initial sense of some of the conversations about typically kind of what mainstream managers and businesses should be doing. I suppose I've kind of held on to that kind of questioning, trying to discover what else is out there, and that's led me down a sort of critical route that asks us to think about that context of business in society as also being about in the environment, in the kind of ecological systems that we rely on. And there's a home for that kind of thinking about management at Huddersfield and in business schools, which I think is a good sign for the type of students that we produce, but also the type of research that we do. So bridging, if you like, some of the grand challenges of our time with the future careers that our students will have, but also with how we understand, maybe rethink the role that businesses have, that organizations have to play in a more sustainable future.
You're always aware of that, making an impact, but you also grew up in a car culture, and one which the rest of the world characterizes at least as rampant consumerism. Were you aware of that challenge when you were growing up? And if you were, what changed it, or what opened your eyes, or had you rethinking it?
I suppose in one sense, in the kind of general sense, we are, as human beings, kind of a product of the environment we grow up in. And it can be difficult to step outside of that while you're still within it, kind of by definition. But I think maybe in the kind of information society that was accelerating, still is, when I was growing up, there was a kind of ability to access more information and knowledge from elsewhere and about elsewhere. And so I remember, must have been about 10 years old, and there was a sort of a fundraiser for my school. And, you know, you could buy shirts that would help support a charity. And the shirt that I bought, still have it. It showed, it was a cartoon that showed a tree that had been cut down. And the tree had a plaque on it that said, the last old growth forest. And the two lumberjacks standing next to it said, makes you feel kind of small, doesn't it? So I don't know, there was dozens of potential t-shirts that I could have bought in this little fundraiser, but that one somehow resonated with my 10-year-old mind. So even though I was within this Western capitalist consumerist culture, kind of in some ways the sort of hub of kind of a lot of what we think about in terms of American, air quotes, culture, I was always kind of looking at it, maybe questioning or wondering, you know, why. And I suppose that question has kind of pushed me forwards since.
So given that why business? Why management? Didn't management and business get us into this mess?
They did, to some degree. The Marxists would say that so did the circulation of capital. And some of my colleagues would perhaps optimistically say that the solutions can be found within these existing ways of doing and thinking about management and business, and that we can sort of reform the status quo. I don't know if I hold those views necessarily, but what I can say is that managing, and I'm using Martin Parker's ideas here, so credit where it's due, managing is only one form of organizing. So management is part of a broader set of practices that I think we can conceive of maybe as organization. So I think that kind of maybe frees us from the sort of weights or constraints that are placed on us if we take management per se as the focus of inquiry and learning and investigation. So, in other words, to answer your question, I think in organizations there are, and in organization more broadly, both formal and informal, there exists a bit more hope or transformative potential or prefiguration of what is to come. And my research really looks at what are those alternatives that are already existing in the here and now within the constraints of the structures that exist, the state, this capitalist market-based economy, but things are being done differently. There's a sort of more diverse economies at play. You know, and we're not all just rational, self-interested profit maximizers. We're also caring and thinking about our communities and nostalgic. We're complex, and so are organizations. I think the name of my department perhaps doesn't capture that complexity. But I think once you peer under the surface, there's a lot more richness to organizing, to department of organization. Maybe I'll take that to my head of department.
Let's take the first of your music choices. Let's have Herbie Hancock, Watermelon Man. Why this one?
Yeah, well, so both of my music choices have a bit of nostalgia to them. This song I played in middle school band, in our jazz band. And, you know, it's a song I can kind of hum now 20-odd years later and still kind of remember those sessions and the kind of creative impulse that was allowed expression.
Thank you.
Duke teaching and researching at the University of Huddersfield, although you told me you live in Manchester.
Indeed.
How was your, in our sense, how was your bubble life? How was your pandemic?
It was, well, before I talk about my own, I think it's interesting that, and I'm grateful to you for recalling it, because we've all experienced it. One of these rare unifying moments around the world, and it was a pretty long moment. But it's, I think there's this kind of seductive temptation to resist recalling it or to act like it never happened. And I think it's important that we acknowledge the scars and the incredible amount of personal development and the trauma and the possibilities that came out of the lockdown, but then subsequently the kind of phased opening, closing down, and all this kind of mismanaged progress since. I think too often we sort of, you know, we want to just get back to the way things were. The way things were was incredibly problematic for social and ecological reasons that I don't perhaps need to go into. But we seem to have largely followed our kind of aspiration and gone back to that. So in a sense, there's a sort of missed opportunity. And I think maybe a bit more reflection would be helpful, or maybe overdue even. My pandemic was sort of, it was fantastic in one sense. I was finishing the revisions after my PhD viva, the kind of small changes I had to make, and it was the warmest summer and spring I think we'd had in as long as I've been in the UK, and I have these some really distinct memories of, you know, being out walking and sitting in a field, overheating, reading a book. You know, I can tell you the book, I can tell you the arguments of it. It's these kind of really strong impressions. And my partner and I, during this kind of pandemic, moved in together. We, you know, have a house, and it was an incredible flourishing of our relationship. I got this role at Huddersfield, and it was profoundly traumatic as well. And I think we need to maybe, you know, give space for those kind of memories of, you know, missed family and parties for big birthdays that were held online. And so these moments were still marked in time, but were, you know, we had to kind of accept this sort of changed reality. But yeah, I'm glad and grateful that the outcomes that the pandemic delivered are what they are. And, you know, I wouldn't be here without it.
Did you start teaching during the time that places were still locked down?
Yeah.
So you couldn't... How did you, like, do your induction? Was that remote as well?
Yeah, yeah. Induction was all on Teams meetings with colleagues who I now know, but at the time were these sort of floating heads. We did do some in-person teaching in the, you know, what seem now almost ridiculous social distanced conditions. So I was teaching through a mask, which it's pretty difficult to... speak loudly and catch your breath. Students were spread out on, you know, one to a two-person desk, masks. It was quite a strange induction and beginning of my academic career. I'd taught before that, so I was more used to the kind of liveliness of a packed classroom. And I wonder as well, you know, to what extent my students were impacted and how they had to readjust to in being in person after a big period of time online. And, you know, if their approach to learning is different now as a result. And, you know, in some conversations, students will acknowledge that. And I think with colleagues, we see the consequences of difference.
Do you think it's had any impact on those students in terms of their career pathways and the expectations of their careers?
Well, I think the one thing everybody talks about is the kind of increasing expectation for hybrid or flexible working arrangements. I'd like to think, as I kind of said earlier, that there were some deeper consequences to this that I don't think we'll probably ever be able to really grasp fully. But, you know, those kinds of things like reconnecting with your local community or your local place, or, on the other hand, an increasingly digitized learning environment, I think the longer-term outcomes for students will be, as they look at their career, might be around investing in their career in the place where they live or the place they care about, or an increasingly virtual learning, working environment. But those are just two directions. I think there will be countless others.
Sustainability has, to some extent, always come down to that tension and, I don't want to say balance, the relationship between global and local. Mm. You know, think global, act local. And as you're saying that, I was thinking that experience of becoming more localized, but also the removal of distance becoming normalized as kind of that global effect. I wonder if that's a model for how we actually can do being both local and global.
And what role does technology in the sort of high-tech information technology sense have in a world where biophysical constraints mean there's only so much copper and lithium that can power all that technology? How global can we stay as we run up against those resource limits?
So I'm associated with the field of collapse informatics. Even though I kind of don't agree with it, it's still, people put my name against it. And one of the reasons why I kind of don't agree with it is because I think it's a bit defeatist. Let's not assume that sustainability is going to fail and what's the implications for computing. And if you question it, then they'll come back and say, oh, but also the things we're going to do in that eventuality will also be beneficial for sustainability. But I just can't bring myself to think about that framing. I think we can still believe that we can make a difference. But the notion of we're designing computing systems for a world that doesn't actually exist anymore. We're designing computers which more and more require constant power source, that require, you know, stuff going to the cloud, so we have constant Wi-Fi, all those sorts of things. And that's just not happening. So there is a real argument that we do need to be preparing ourselves for that systems falling apart world. We might call it a VUCA world or whatever it is. Is there a collapse organization?
Well, I think there's some interesting overlap with your collapse
informatics.
Informatics, and
it comes out of California, out of Irvine.
Oh, yeah.
Bill Tomlinson's work in Irvine.
Okay. This resonates with an interest I have in what's kind of an emerging academic field, social movement. Called degrowth. So the question you sort of pose, I mean, is there a sort of degrowth organization? Maybe it would be a kind of reworking of it. And in a sense, yes. And I think those diverse forms of organizing that I take as my interest. I'm by no means the only one pursuing these. Those are forms of organizing, practices of organizing that try to move past the sort of growth imperative that a lot of organizations and that economies have built in, programmed in, if you like. So there are modes of doing organization that I think will become increasingly important and prevalent as we move towards an increasingly volatile, unstable, and so on world. I don't think I can carry on with a kind of by adopting the sort of doom and gloom defeatist approach. So we're in the same boat. I think we have to and will inevitably persist as a species, and we're incredibly resilient. And I think trying to foreground some of those types of practices, those types of organizations, is a small part in trying to point to the future forms of organization that that need to scale up, if you like, or scale out.
Bubble sprite of the forest of Orokinui, Dunedin's favourite goddess, Tahu Mackenzie.
Kia ora koutou, ngā mihi karohanui, kia koutou, ko tahu hau. I hope you're all having the best day, beautiful superstars, in your beloved universes. And I really hope, wherever you are, and whatever's happening around you, this journey that we're all on together is proving to be very rewarding, very sustaining, and illuminating for you more and more each day, who you are. The triumph of nature's art, perfect, unique, and here, making things better. Thank you. Now, I know that for us all, the last more than 3 years have been very tough, and it's so important that we give ourselves the time and the space that we need now to rest, to recalibrate, to recover, and to draw upon those new and those pre-existing skills that we have found ourselves constantly needing to use over the last several years. I know for myself, the living world is a constant comfort. And tomorrow I will be venturing forth to my heart's home workplace, Orokinui Eco Sanctuary, and showing one of my dear friends, Ali East, and her beautiful whānau all around the Eco Sanctuary. And this will be a great treat for me. And Ali East is an amazing, very creative genius goddess who has travelled the world several times over, and is a dance professor and great performer and storyteller. And in her travels, she encourages students from all over the world to go and study traditional dances and to learn the ways and learn the rites and learn the life ways of those who have developed those traditional dances. And not only to admire and respect the dancers, but also that long lineage of lives and stories and understanding that has informed all of those dancers. And she encourages them to write poetry and do art and not only dance, but also enshrine dance by conceptualizing its magic in so many different ways. So I have great admiration for her, and I'm very excited to show her and her beautiful family around tomorrow. And of course, this got me thinking about how we are all tour guides in our lives, and what a treat it is to be able to share those special aspects of our lives with those that we love and with everybody around us. What a treat it is to take on that role as a guide, as a tour guide, and share our knowledge, share our appreciation, share those points of connection that are different for everybody, and tell the stories that have underpinned and created the way that we live our life. I know for myself that recently I have undergone quite a personal transformation, and after years, in fact my whole life, of living with the open plan filing system and an abundance of treasure, I have released a great amount of treasure back to the universe and now live in an incredibly orderly and spacious and capacious mansion, which is very clean and tidy, and this is a whole new world for me. And what it has meant is that I take great joy in being a tour guide for my dear friends and those I love and those around me of my mansion, of my house, and having people come round is now a great pleasure and a great joy because they don't have to navigate the open plan filing system. So I really hope for you that you're finding ways within your life to enjoy those opportunities to share what is magic for you, what is meaningful for you. And whether it's taking a walk around a beautiful place that you love, as I will tomorrow at Orokonui Eco Sanctuary, or whether it is allowing an aspect of yourself to come forward and view your life in a whole new way, allowing a part of you to see how far you've come, sharing a part of yourself with someone you love dearly, allowing them to enjoy the beauty of your home, whatever it is that you want to share. I hope that you really enjoy being the tour guide and sharing your knowledge and your passion. And I want to say a huge thank you to Sam and the whole Blowing Bubbles team for having me, and I look forward to talking to you again soon. Thanks so much. Ka kite.
You're listening to Blowing Bubbles by Sustainable Lens. I'm with James Scott, Levanta Vanta. James, before Tahu, you were talking about alternative forms of organisation, but also the need to be positive and maintain that positive mindset. What's the role of a positive mindset for you?
Well, every action we have has consequences, and I think if we can be motivated and inspired with that that mindset that things can get better, the consequences will follow. So I'm sure there's all sorts of much more knowledgeable people than me on kind of motivation and outcome. But at an intuitive level, I think we, so long as we are driven to try to make the world a better place in some small way, right? We're not going to transform things at the click of a button. But as long as we hold on to that, the world seems like a bit brighter of a place, a world that I want to live in.
Thinking of organizations and organizational structures, I've always been impressed by the Transition Towns movement. And in particular, the strong philosophy is we're not trying to convince anybody. We're getting on with living a better life. And if other people want to join us, that's great too. Does that work in terms of an organization that is actually sustainable in the long-term viable perspective in terms of the making that difference and to getting the jump from incremental change to transformative change? Or are there other organizational structures that are better at, you know, pulling off that multi-pronged challenge?
Yeah, well, the Transition Towns movement, has done some incredible things with getting people involved as and when they want to be. And I think participating in a kind of broader political narrative about and bringing to political attention climate change and peak oil. So they sort of play a political role as well. I think there are as well all sorts of organizations that are restructuring or structured themselves from the outset in a way that distances the imperative to maximize shareholder value. That's the legal definition of a PLC in the UK, an LLC, the limited liability publicly traded corporation that we commonly think about and a lot of management focuses on. this is the realm where CSR has kind of taken root. But there are other ways of organizing and thinking about, in particular, the work of Jennifer Hinton, who drills down to the level of relationship to profit that is then incorporated into the legal structure that an organization adopts. That is, well, she says that's the most difficult to change, the relationship to profit. But if you can get to that core level, you are looking at an organization that is designed with a different purpose in mind. So I've done some research on housing associations in the UK, which are not-for-profit, legally designated as not-for-profit organizations. Now, does that mean they're perfect? No. But it means that they have a social purpose and that ecological considerations can, to some degree, feature in the choices that they make. Now, perhaps even more compelling examples are in the community-led housing movement, where cooperative models community land trusts and legal structures that embed place or, like the example of Patagonia, put ecological considerations into the boardroom, or the profits are directed towards, in Patagonia's case, directed towards ecological advocacy or practices. And I think Patagonia often gets kind of trotted out as the fantastic example of this, but there are countless others. And I think focusing in on legal structure, on organizational structure, one element of research in management schools and departments, and there are others, you can already start to see that there's all kinds of other ways of doing that are already happening now that can inspire others and that are beginning to put into practice more social, more ecological ways of organizing.
I want to come back to that, but first we need to squeeze in the second of your music choices. No Doubt, Rocksteady. Why this one?
Again, nostalgia. This was the first concert I went to. Saw No Doubt and Blink-182 out in the rural countryside, such that it is in hot California, outside of LA. So fond memory of listening to Gwen Stefani and enjoying a nice evening.
Our love is rock steady, our love is so rock steady, rock steady, rock steady, rock steady.
Organizations designed with a different purpose in mind. I know this answer to this is going to be, it's complicated, but bear with me. Is it an ideal organization if we want to set up something which is has as its purpose positively contributing to a thriving socio-ecological system, which is my current take on what sustainability means? Is there an ideal model?
Well, you're absolutely right. It's complicated.
We'll tick that box.
But I think we could maybe outline some broad propositions that that type of organization might embody. So I think one would be around this kind of question we addressed previously around legal structure. What choices are made at the initial phases of setting up an organization are incredibly important. So the relationship to profit, the incorporation structure that's taken by the founders, by the board, whoever it is, that would be, I think, incredibly consequential. Now, is there one ideal type? I don't think so. And that kind of leads me maybe to the second point, which is that I think organizations that are place-based. Now, some of my current research is building from this understanding that actually all organizations are place-based, that in the UK, the big supermarkets, Tesco, Sainsbury's, or you know, Google, they all, organization happens in places. But what I suppose I'm suggesting is that these organizations are embedded in local places where local concerns fit with and within the mission or the purpose of that organization. So I think there's a kind of implication for that about organizational scale, about the size of an organization that can meaningfully embed itself in a local community and feel like it's part of a place. Third, maybe proposition that this organization would recognize the importance of political narrative, that they are not going to, political, by the way, not in the sense of what the politicians are talking about, but rather in the sense that, the kind of original sense of the term, that the polis, the people in the kind of Greek city-state, or in this case, the place, that organizations have a political role to play and a function. And the choices that are made within the organization have consequences elsewhere. Those consequences can be in the local area, around workers, wages they pay, suppliers that they're working with, waste and pollution, but it's also about supply chains and not just how much local sourcing is taking place, but what is the longest supply chain that an organization relies on, what choices are made about mobility for employees, and then much broader than that even, what is the contribution of that organization towards changing geophysical systems. Now, these are maybe questions that you wouldn't think to raise in the day-to-day functioning of an organization, but I think they can fit into the broader conversations around strategy and planning and where organizations want to be aiming towards. So if you like, that kind of political proposition is by implication a strategic reorientation for these organizations. So maybe I'll leave it there with a couple of propositions, but underpinned by that understanding that this would be complicated and different, mm-hmm. based on different legal structures relevant to different places and in different political contexts.
You talked about the relationship to profit and the implications of the legal structure of that. It's not possible to have either a tree in the boardroom or future generations in the boardroom. Are there any models that are able to take that, or actually it is possible to have disadvantaged communities in the boardroom? So you can solve that one with a structure. But what are the answers to those other ones, the future generations and the environment, of actually getting them, you know, I know a tree can't be part of the decision-making process, but getting that central to the decision-making?
Yeah, it's so efforts have been made to bring those kind of voices into the boardroom. But I don't think there is an easy answer there. I mean, I wonder what it would look like to hold a board meeting in a forest where the boardroom is trees, or to do some of the kind of exercises that have been done really successfully in terms of forecasting or backcasting, rather, and setting yourself in 2050 as a board, where are you, and then working back, you know, how did we get there? The short answer is, and maybe this links to the sort of optimistic view of human nature that I have. If you move away from this kind of profit imperative and encourage more democratic decision making, with more stake in the organization, that unlocks in people the ability to gather more information, to learn, not to become enlightened overnight, but rather to say, well, I can actually decide with my fellow employees where we're going to source raw materials, what wage we're going to pay, how much we want to emphasize ecological benefit or economic benefit now at the expense of future generations. I think that phrase actually features in, you know, the Brundtland Commission's definition of sustainable development, but it's quite problematic and vague. And I think we maybe could concretize it more, whether it's through a sort of, yeah, this kind of backcasting exercise, or through learning, shared learning processes within an organization about, well, who will be impacted in the future. So it's a tough question, and I think that innate desire to learn is maybe a way that we can, harnessing that in organizations is a way that we can work towards giving nature, giving those that haven't been born yet or that don't have a voice yet, consideration, due consideration.
Okay, some easier questions to end with, and zero time, so we're going to have to really rattle through these. What is the biggest success you've had in the last couple of years?
Finishing my PhD, without a doubt, at a professional level. I think that was a monumentous task and dramatic in its own ways, and a very big success and joy at reaching the end of it. PhD is never perfect, but it's finished, and I think I definitely finished.
So we're writing a book of these conversations. It's called Tomorrow's Heroes. It's our team of people doing good work. So you're in that team. What's your superpower?
I'm freeing people's time, giving them a little bit less time having to work. May still choose to work, but they can work if they want to.
What motivates you? What gets you out of bed in the morning?
Well, as we've spoken about, I've got the sort of optimism of somebody who sees the possibilities for change, hopes that there can be a better tomorrow, and I think in my daily life, making the kinds of small steps in that direction is what gets me out of the bed.
So in terms of a better life but a big step, if you could wave a magic wand and have a miracle occur, what would you have happen?
Gosh. Well, I think if we steadily increased carbon taxes year on year with broad public support, using the revenue for that to invest in a green transformation and in, as I've spoken about, these variety of alternative business models of different organizational structures, places, and political narratives, I think the world would be in a lot better shape. But again, I think the importance of that being my magic wand would somehow bring people's minds around to the reasonable, how reasonable it is to expect that we can't keep burning carbon and emitting at the rates we are.
So very quickly then, to beat the vacuum cleaner, do you consider yourself to be an activist?
Yes, I am an activist and I'm an academic. I'm not a scholar activist with a hyphen. I think that's places a lot of pressure, undue pressure. And I'm working with a colleague, and we're sort of right now, and we're sort of rethinking maybe, do we need to try to be this kind of all in one, everything, everywhere, all at once, or can we be activist? Be on a journey of becoming activist, really, while still on this journey of becoming academic. And those are related, but not kind of entwined. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I do some activist work and academic work.
What's the biggest challenge or opportunity that you're looking forward to in the next year or so?
I am very much looking forward to a few conferences that I've organized, bringing these kind of academics that have activist interests together. Building networks, I think, will be an important element of that. So I'm actually going to the Post-Growth Innovation Lab in Pontevedra, Spain, that's affiliated with the University of Vigo in 2 weeks. And they're kind of working to deepen ties within the network of people who are doing research on degrowth and organization. And I think the next year will really lead to a flourishing of some of those networks. I'm involved in a few others as well, but that one's coming up, so I'm certainly looking forward to that.
And lastly, do you have any advice for our listeners?
Hold on to hope. And don't let the narrative that relinquishes hope win.
Sounds good to me. James, thank you very much for joining me.
Thank you, Sam.
Been listening to Blowing Bubbles by Sustainable Lens, brought to you by the Sustainable Lens team, who are brought to you by Otago Polytechnic, Te Pukenga. We're broadcast on Otago Access Radio Wednesday afternoons at 3 and streamed and podcast on oar.org.nz. You can find us on Facebook.
We had a contribution today from Tahu McKenzie. This is Blink 182. I'm Simon Mann with James Scott Van Deventer at the University of Huddersfield. Over that to Blowing Bubbles by Sustainable Lens. We hope you enjoyed the show. Marty Wah.
This podcast was produced by ORFM Dunedin with support from New Zealand On Air.